Hi, friends. Welcome to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today, we are joined by Dr. James Albert, who is a professor of evolutionary biology here at UL Lafayette. Dr. Albert was born in Los Angeles, went to high school at Laguna Beach High School, go Breakers, went to college at Brandeis before transferring to Berkeley. Somehow he went wrong. He was a political science major, but then decided biology was his love. So I'm going to try to convince him to switch back, but I doubt I'll have much luck. Then he went on to Michigan, where he got a master's and a PhD in evolutionary biology, short stops in Tokyo and Gainesville before coming to UL in 2005, where he is a professor in the biology department. And the world's perhaps foremost expert in the area of electric fish. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Pearson. It's great to be here.
You are a professor of biology at UL Lafayette. You've written widely on evolutionary biology, biogeography, biodiversity, and conservation. You look at diversity and the evolution of Amazonian fishes in particular. So just explain this a little bit. How does someone get interested in biology and then get interested in fish?
Well, thank you for this invitation to talk about fresh waters and freshwater biodiversity and to get the message out to the listeners. When I was growing up, I was taught there were some basic questions in science: the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of mind, and also the origin of morals and ethics. And when I was young, I was idealistic, and I wanted to try to hit as many of those topics as I could. So I ended up picking electric fish because, first, we don't know very much about their biological evolution, and also this electric sense they have is a good model for understanding how the brain works in a vertebrate.
So what were those four things? It was morals, mind, universe, and what was the
life?
Life. Origin of all those and the development of them. So you skipped on all the other ones and you went to that one. I guess you don't do a lot of fish ethics.
Well, there is, there actually is a lot of ethics in fish, especially the conservation side of things.
Good point.
Yeah.
So that brings up all those, and we'll talk about that in just a second. Let's talk about the biodiversity crisis. So what is this crisis?
Well, as many of the listeners are probably aware, humans are leaving a very large footprint, environmental footprint on the world. It's true for atmospheric carbon dioxide. It's true for plastics. It's true for fishes, freshwater in general. There are many places in the world, for example, the American Southwest, where major rivers no longer make it to the sea. The Colorado River is dry before it reaches the Gulf of California. Now, here in the southeastern U.S., we have a lot of water. Sometimes we have too much water. We don't necessarily see that part of the crisis, but we do have related issues with respect to sea levels rising, saltwater intruding into coastal marshes, and intruding into our aquifer. We're sitting on a really wonderful resource of fresh waters below our feet in the Chico Aquifer. And there are parts of the Chico Aquifer that are getting salty. So that's an issue that we all should be thinking about.
Let's back up a little bit. You said, okay, so there's this crisis in freshwater. Now, most people, when they think about, okay, human footprint, they think perhaps the temperature of the earth is going up, and then they hear about the rise in melting of ice, the rise of sea levels. So, and then they think about overfishing. But most of that, I think, has been focused on the ocean. So you're talking about freshwater. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit. How much freshwater in the world is there compared to saltwater, and how many fish species and those kinds of things?
Well, that's the thing that I think is the hidden part of the story. Most conservation efforts are directed towards land animals because that's where we live. When people think about water, they think about the oceans. But it turns out that about half of all vertebrate species live in fresh waters, mostly fishes. It's this incredibly dense concentration of species. The numbers for vertebrates are we have about 30,000 species and about 15,000 of them live in rivers and lakes, mostly rivers actually. So there's this really high density of species, but also of lineages, ecological traits, and all of the ecosystem services that fishes and other freshwater organisms, even insects, do.
So there are about 30,000 vertebrate species.
Oh, fishes. There's another 30,000 land vertebrates.
Right. Okay. 30,000. Because I was saying, geez, I thought there were more than that.
Yeah. Well, all the amphibians reptiles, birds, and mammals together are about the same as the fishes of the world. And the fishes are divided about half also in freshwater and ocean. But think of how much ocean there is. It's less than a tenth of a percent of the world's water is in rivers, in flowing in rivers.
So, less than one-tenth.
Yeah.
Of course, that would be very transient because if it's in a river, it's flowing from someplace to another place, right?
Yes.
So at
and
any
thank
one
goodness,
point.
And we always have precipitation, so rivers are recharged, and aquifers as well. They're slower to recharge, but they do recharge over time.
So that's about 0.10% of the world's water is in movement at any moment from a reservoir to the ocean is essentially
correct.
The movement. Okay. Interesting. So enormous. Now, that doesn't account for just freshwater and lakes and other things that are – it's freshwater, but it's not moving.
Well, most of the world's freshwater is in a few lakes.
Yeah, the Baikal.
Yeah, Lake Baikal in Siberia has 20% of all the world's freshwater.
The Great Lakes.
Yeah, the Great Lakes, North America. And then, of course, most of the world's running water is in one river. 20% is just in the Amazon River, which is not very useful for most people who don't live in South America. But in the parts of the world where people live, in North America, in Asia, in Europe, we use most of the fresh water that moves to the sea. The numbers are really astonishing. About overall, about a third of all the fresh water now that's moving on the surface of the planet is passing through human agricultural or industrial facilities. And we have now already farmed about one-fifth of all the land that can be farmed, including, of course, all the good land, because the good land goes first.
So about one-fifth of all the land that could be farmed, and we're using currently about one-third of all the water that's flowing.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow, pretty impressive. I guess, go humans. We're really making a wave.
Well, that's the thing is we have 7.7 billion of us, and then we have all of our food crops. So at any given time, there are 18 billion chickens in the world, billions of cattle. The numbers are really – humans are big. The number of chickens alive today is more than all the wild birds of the world combined.
Wow.
So that's just to show you how big our ecological footprint is. We use about a third of all of the calories that the biosphere produces that pass through human ecosystems.
That's pretty incredible. So, and actually, that leads us to our next point, because I'm thinking a lot of those calories now that we're doing are kind of monoculture, if you think about it in the standpoint of – yeah, we produce an extraordinary amount of soybeans and rice and corn and other these kind of big crops, but that doesn't say much about diversity in terms of all those. So let's talk about biodiversity. Is there a crisis about biodiversity? Should we care about biodiversity? Or do we just really need lots of chickens, lots of cattle, lots of corn and rice, and we can do just fine on that?
Well, we certainly do need lots of those. I mean, like everybody, I like chicken and corn and rice. But the question is how to manage going forward. These, as a lot of the listeners may be aware, monocultures are sensitive. They don't have a lot of diversity. And so pests can come through and destroy an entire industry. Right now, in fact, bananas are the next major crisis. There's a fungus that's spreading around the world, and the current monoculture of banana that's grown all over the world is imperiled, and the industry is frantically searching for a replacement.
Somebody told me that all the bananas are essentially the same species.
The same variety of the same species.
Really?
Yeah. Not all the bananas, but all the bananas that are marketed in the United States. But if you go to tropical countries, you'll find all sorts of other sweeter bananas that just don't survive the transit as well.
So the reason why our bananas look so good and taste so bad is because they are really good for ocean travel.
That's exactly right.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's talk about this in terms of fish. So when we say biodiversity and we have, you said, 30,000 species of freshwater fish, is that right?
Of them are fishes, yeah.
Half of them are fish, okay.
I'm sorry. Half of them are freshwater fish.
Half of them are freshwater
fish. The other half
fish.
Are coral reef fish and things like that.
I gotcha. Okay. So there are about 15,000 varieties of freshwater fish.
Correct.
What's the crisis here in biodiversity? What's happening?
Well, there's many crises, and they're all interlocking. One of them, you can see it's happening for the fishes, but it's easy. Fishes are a little bit out of sight unless you're a fisherman, where you know that fishing populations are down, even in places like South Louisiana, which are still pretty good in terms of national standards. But what you really the real way to assess this is just to go out at night and look at a lamp in the dark, and you'll see hardly any bugs around that lamp in town. Even in the country, even if you go out into some more remote places, the number of insects are down by 90% since the time when you and I were kids in Lafayette. These are numbers. People have them. And it's true all over North America because every year – I mean, nobody wants West Nile and nobody wants malaria. But every year we dump a lot of pesticides, and the cumulative effect over years and decades of application is insect populations are just going down and down. And, of course, insects are the food of most of the birds. Therefore, the bird populations are down. And a recent North American survey found we are down 90% from the 1970s in bird populations. The same is true for the fishes. In fact, it's worse. The rate of decline in populations of aquatic animals, amphibians, and fishes is faster than it is for the birds and the mammals. So it's not only extinction of species, but just the entire system is being replaced with human systems. And, of course, we rely on natural systems for billions and billions of dollars in services, not the least of which is making our clean water and our clean air, which are bacteria and things that live in wetlands and marshes and all the aquatic systems.
Well, first of all, I'm stunned. I mean, this sounds awful. So let's review these numbers. 90% of insect species are down. It's down 90% since
the abundances since the 1970s.
Since the 1970s.
Right.
So we're not talking 1870s.
No, baseline for the Living Planet Index is 1970. And you can look at the curve. They monitor populations, a set of populations, several thousand populations across Europe and North America, and they look at terrestrial and freshwater populations. And
birds are down 90%.
Birds are down. Everything is down. And the freshwater populations, just in terms of abundances, like how many minnows are out there, how many channel catfish are out there, things like that.
Wow. Well, we are – I'm certainly shocked by those numbers. I'm glad you're telling us those, even though they are shocking. We are talking today with Dr. James Albert about the freshwater biodiversity crisis, and we are going to be back and talk just a little bit more in a few minutes.
Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses through KRVS program sponsorship. For more information, call 337-482-1437, and thank you.
Hello, this is John Green, host of Night Train Jazz, inviting you to tune in every Tuesday from 8 to 10 for 2 hours of the very latest recorded jazz, as well as a sprinkling of oldies but goodies. That's Night Train, Tuesdays from 8 to 10 here on KRVS 88.7 FM in Lafayette and Lake Charles.
Hello and welcome back to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today we're joined by Dr. James Albert to talk about the freshwater biodiversity crisis. So Dr. Albert had to talk me out of slashing my wrists as we left for break with the statistics on the decline in life on this planet in terms of insects, birds, and fish. But let's put it in a specific context that might mean something to people here in Acadiana. So talk to me about fish diversity and in the context of the Mississippi or the Chafalaya or somewhere in there. Those are regions that, as I understand, you go in and actually do kind of measure fish diversity and things like that. Could you tell us about those with your students?
Yes. In fact, this semester I teach ichthyology, and we have field trips to various localities around the state. We go to Butte La Rose, boat launch, because that's a nice, easy to sample place. So you can get baseline measures and then monitor those as they change through time. And in a sense, there's some good news. Locally, things aren't that bad. Louisiana, the southeast of the United States in general, is not changing very much yet in climate change. The western United States is drying out rapidly. In other parts of the world, Australia, you may have heard on the news, there are wildfires. But the southeastern United States hasn't really changed its total precipitation, although the precipitation is changing to being more intense with fewer, bigger storms. But the total amount of water is about the same. And it's true, our populations are more under threat from development, draining of wetlands, and urban development. But even those aren't catastrophic yet. Louisiana doesn't have the same population boom, say, that the Houston area has, for example. And so you still find a lot of really excellent fishes. We're still living in a pretty beautiful place here in the Chaffalai Basin. We have lots of big ancient fishes like gars and bowfins and sturgeons and paddlefish. I mean, the list goes on. We're really for an ichthyologist, this is a great place to do business.
So when you go out with these students, do you actually get in the water?
Absolutely. That's the thing that other botanists and ornithologists will bring their thigh boots, but that's not going to work for us. We're going in up to our noses.
Really? And so what do you just swim around and try to catch fish? That hasn't worked for me in the past.
Well, there's a bunch of tricks to the trade, various okay. different kinds of nets. We have seine nets, beach seines. You can go fish with trawl nets, dip nets. If you really want to get serious and if you're a professional, you use electrofishing, so you really can try to get everything. There are many different techniques. Fish and wildlife people, they're not screwing around. They have to find out what is there, and especially when it comes to monitoring invasive species, a lot of different carp species that have gotten into our waters.
So we still have gars. Are gars natural to this area?
Yes, in fact. Mm-hmm. There's only 7 species of gars on this world, and 4 of them can be caught from less than a half a day drive from where I'm sitting right now.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So we are the center of diversity for gars.
Center of diversity for a fish that nobody wants, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah. People like gar balls. It's not that great, but if you deep fry it and put Tabasco, it's going
to
be.
Anything deep fried with Tabasco on it tastes pretty good, I've discovered. Just about. So tell me about diversity. So like when you pull fish out, you know, you referred to, I guess, the electric technique that would get all the fish. So when you pull it out, what do you see? I mean, how many species do you typically collect and what do they look like?
Well, this semester in our class, we didn't do very heavy fishing. We had 4 weekend field trips, and I think our total count is about 70 species, mm-hmm. which is, that's not all the species in South Louisiana, but it's a good sample of the more abundant common ones.
What's the most abundant common ones that you
This is a fascinating thing about biodiversity, whether it's birds or the dragonflies of Madagascar or whatever it is, the fishes of the Chaffalai Basin. There's always one most common species that's like a third to a half. In our case, it's the black spot shiner. Cyprinella venusta.
Black spot shiner.
Yeah, it's
How
a little.
I've never heard of that fish.
It's not commercially fished. They're an important food fish for larger commercially fished.
So they're like rabbits. They're at the bottom of the food chain.
Exactly. Where
so you don't really think about rabbits as noble creatures of the wild, but without them, those other creatures don't exist.
Without the black spot shiner and a dozen other common small-bodied herbivorous fishes that are passing energy up through
herbivorous
the food chain.
Means that they eat plants.
Yeah, eat algae and stuff off the bottom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are the base of the food chain that all of the sport fish are eating.
Did you catch anything rare or exciting that excited you this semester?
We always catch cool things. I guess one of the most exciting things was not this year, but last year there was a flood event and this was 2 years ago, they opened the Bonacari, I believe, mm-hmm. and we caught a fish that has never been reported in the Chaffalai before because that normally they live further up in the Mississippi Basin. But the big floods, I guess, had brought this thing down. It's called a golden eye. So.
The golden eye. Yes. Okay. Wow. This sounds like a James Bond fish.
Well, that's the thing is when you get to the small end of the size spectrum, there are a lot more species.
Let's talk about that. Okay, yeah. So when we talk about biodiversity, most of the species are not red snapper, right? Most of the species are these kind of little fish that nobody knows about, like the most common one that I'd never heard of before, the black spot shiner. Mm-hmm. Why should we care about these fish? I mean, when you say biodiversity, I mean, isn't this one of the things? Yes, I can imagine a campaign, save the black spot shiner. Make the argument.
It's true. Humans are obviously more fascinated by large things that we can cuddle. Panda bears and large mammals are
or
great.
Even admire or be scared of, like yeah. lions and great white sharks and
right.
things like
That's
that.
That's right. Yeah. But all of those large animals are part of a giant web of life. And one of the things we know about biology is that backup systems are essential. If you have only one genetic variety or one species – and it gets hit by a disease or by a predator or whatever.
A.K.A. bananas.
Yeah. Then that's another piece of the system. The systems are quite resilient. So you can actually afford to lose a number of species and the ecosystem doesn't collapse. But ecosystems can and do collapse. That's the take-home message we know from looking at around the world today and also looking into the geological past. There have been, of course, times in the past when the entire Earth's biosphere collapsed and almost everything went extinct. This happened several times in the past billion years. And so it's not impossible. I'm not making the claim that's likely to happen anytime soon, but we should be cognizant of these so-called tipping points where you push the system past its zone of resilience and then you do a phase shift to a new normal. And that new normal will not be very happy for us.
You know, there have been some books written about this. I think the Sixth Extinction is the most recent that I read about, humans – you know, this era that we're in, the Anthropocene, is actually causing this giant die-off across the planet. Do you think there's any credence to that based on what you've seen in terms of freshwater diversity?
I would say every freshwater biologist, every environmental biologist thinks that's happening, without exception. When you go to meetings, people don't talk anymore about stopping climate change. We're talking about adapting to climate change. It's ongoing. It's happening. And the question is, we can't go backwards. We can't undo our technological advances, nor would I even want to. I like modern life. I like modern vaccines, modern medicine, and all the rest of it. But the question is, how do we go forward so that we can continue to have a beautiful green planet?
Speaking of less than beautiful and green, what about the Australian outback in Africa? I mean, they're seeing catastrophic changes there, probably as a result of – they're seeing the kind of changes that people talk about in crisis terms that we have not yet seen here, perhaps in southeastern United States. So what's happening there and what implications does that have for those ecosystems?
Yeah, part of global climate change, which is a big part of the Anthropocene, this period of human activities, is changing in weather patterns, and it's manifested in many different ways. Many areas that are dry and in the 30-degree north-south latitude zone, the so-called horse latitudes that are the air zones, they're expanding. So Southern California, Northern California, much of the Middle East, North Africa, Central America, Australia. There are wildfires in northern Sweden every summer now. I mean, many, many ecosystems are drying out and the bands of vegetation are shifting north and the deserts are shifting into what was once forest. So it's not likely that Texas is going to be a major agricultural state by the end of the century. It's just becoming a desert.
Well, does that mean as this ban moves up, does that mean, okay, Texas goes offline as a major agricultural state, but southern Canada comes online?
In all changes, there are winners and losers, and you're absolutely right. This will help Canada, probably will help Russia, at least northerner parts of Russia, absolutely, as their agricultural bans move into their territory.
Is it possible at this point to imagine a reversal of freshwater and the threat to biodiversity? Can this be stopped? You said just a second ago that it couldn't be, and you're thinking about managing it. But what should we be doing?
Right. We're not going to – nothing this big stops. You don't stop an ocean liner on a dime. It's a very large system, and it has decades and centuries of inertia behind it. But we can redirect it. You can change the direction and try to reduce some of the worst effects. And, of course, we are very ingenious people. Humans are very ingenious. And one thing I always try to remind myself and my friends is think back to 1919. 100 years ago, imagine what you know about the world from that time. And it was such a different world from today. And we did that. We made all of those changes. And many of them are good. Not all of them are good, but many of them were really remarkable. And so we have the potential to do that. And my guess is that the next 100 years, we will make enormous changes. And I hope we'll have the insight and the foresight to make better changes, make changes for the better.
So much of this, I mean – you know, I talk to people like you, people in the science community in different fields, and the threat is clear and the need for action is clear, and the level of crisis seems to be, you know, debatable depending on what you're looking at or what set of data you're referring to. But we oftentimes don't see that translated into policy. Just this morning I was on Facebook and I saw 30,000 scientists deny climate change is happening. You know, some meme that somebody had posted, you know, that of course is not fact-based. But it just – it makes me pessimistic for the future. I mean, can we get – how do you get people excited about saving the black spot shiner or about doing something about – I mean, I'm stunned by insect loss. I think we've all seen that, or bird loss. I mean, heaven knows we love birds more than, you know, as well as chicken. how do we get people motivated to address these issues, in your opinion? And how do we get politicians to pay attention?
Yeah, so it's a huge it's the question, and I doubt there is a single answer. It's going to require lots
and lots. I was counting on you to give me the answer, by the way.
So. There will be many lines going forward. Many different people are going to try. We're going to need to involve everybody. Scientists are good at coming up with information and maybe disseminating it, but we're not probably the best at weaving the story. We're going to need all of our resources, all of our capacities as people. We have a big asset in Gen Z. My experience has been they are more they don't have any doubt what's happening because they are experiencing it. They can see it. And that this cuts right across party lines. I mean, this is not a political hot potato among, say, the teenagers right now. There may be some people on both sides of this, but it is very well understood as compared to, say, my generation. One thing I always do in my classes and I recommend everybody do is just go to ISS.gov, the International Space Station, and look at those videos they have of cameras, their time-lapse, so you can like go around half the planet in 10 minutes. And you can see how big the human footprint is with all the lights and how thin the atmosphere is. It's this very thin film. It's really obvious when you're on top of the atmosphere that it's not hard for humans to fill the atmosphere with gases. Sitting on the planet looking up at the sky, you think, wow, the world is so huge. And it is pretty big. But we are big. Humans are big. And we are changing the composition of the atmosphere, of the biosphere, of all of those spheres, the cryosphere, the lithosphere. We're literally laying down trillions of tons of concrete that changes the geological nature of the planet. All these spheres, by the way, my daughter calls those pointless spheres because they're spheres. You see, they have no points.
Pointless spheres. So basically, Generation Z may be more focused and may save us. So you know, grandma and gramps, you know, they basically are not seeing it. They don't think it's a crisis here. It's been here a long time, but the younger generation. So we're counting on the kids to save us, basically, is what you're saying.
Sure. I mean, it's going to happen one way or the other. Regardless of what happens, eventually they will inherit the wheels of power, and they will do what they will do. And let's hope that they do better than we did.
Wow. Well, I don't know. I would say they could hardly do worse, but who knows? We've maybe done well in certain areas. So this is interesting. You know, are you in thinking about teaching about the biodiversity and all these issues coming forward? What are you going to focus on?
Well, for me personally, I continue to document biodiversity, naming species. Species don't have legal protection unless they have names. So one of the jobs we have is to give names to species. But the other thing is public actions. I encourage the listeners to go to some websites. I can mention a couple here. One is we have in Lafayette the USGS National Wetland Center on Cajun Dome Boulevard. They have a really wonderful display of coastal wetlands that's worthwhile seeing. You can arrange for travels. And the last thing I'll mention is don't forget World Wetlands Day, which is on February 2nd. You can just Google World Wetlands Day and try to get involved in some of the activities that we have planned for that time.
Well, we should appreciate the wonderful diversity of life we still have here in southeastern United States and southern Louisiana. This is Bayou de Beltway. We've been talking with Dr. James Albert. Thanks for coming to the show today.
My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org.
Funkify your life. Rare grooves with roots in New Orleans and the greater Gulf Coast region. Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Friday nights at 9 here on KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, and at krvs.org.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.